It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Matt Alvarez. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Specialist Richard Duran will be here in a few minutes and will be answering your questions. But we're going to start the day with murder hornets, or mistaking a murder hornet. You may have noticed large wasps hovering around your home or landscape this summer, and as threatening as they may look, they're probably not the Asian giant hornet many feared would sweep across the U.S. No, this hornet is more than likely the cicada killer wasp, a common and frequently large wasp that's present every summer throughout Iowa. And here to tell us more is Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis. Donald, welcome to the program.
Hello, Matt. Good to be here.
So, Donald, I understand Iowa State University Extension entomologists have had a busy summer identifying cicada killer wasp. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We predicted this a couple months ago when the Asian giant hornet made the news. Of course, the Asian giant hornet is a huge wasp, about 2 inches long. It was very much in the news. It was nicknamed by the media the murder hornet. And so it garnered lots of attention. And at that time, we predicted Iowans would think that's what they saw when they encountered an insect we have every summer, and that is the cicada killer wasp. Now, cicada killer wasp is a native species. It's always been here, but it is large. But you get one and actually put a ruler up next to it, it may have looked 3 to 4 inches long when it was buzzing by you, but it's really only about an inch and a half. The abdomen is yellow with some black marks. They're not, they don't go clear across the abdomen, but there are black and yellow markings on the abdomen. One of the distinctive characteristics is the wings are translucent orange. Normally, when we look at a wasp, we think of the wings as being clear, but in the case of the cicada killer wasp, the wings are orangish in color. So we've fielded 40 to 50 phone calls and emails, and the Iowa Department of Agriculture has fielded even more of people asking, is this the Asian giant hornet? And so far, with every call, with every inquiry, we've been able to say, no, it is not the Asian giant hornet. It's just the cicada killer wasp.
Well, that's kind of a relief for most Iowans. Could you tell us, before we continue on the conversation, where the murder hornet or the Asian giant hornet may have been located in the U.S.? Because this was in the headlines about 2 months ago in early May, was it not?
Yes, it was a couple of months ago, and there were discoveries late in 2019 in the state of Washington and across the border in British Columbia. Then in early 2020, there were more found in Washington. I think we're up to maybe 6 to 12 individual Asian giant hornets have been caught. But now everybody is looking. State departments of agriculture have surveys out. The public is looking for this. And so far, it has not been reported elsewhere in the United States. So good news so far. We hope it stays that way.
Sure. And so what are the different behaviors between the cicada killer wasp and the Asian giant hornet?
The cicada killer wasp lives in the ground, and the female digs a tunnel. Sometimes she throws out a lot of soil on top of the ground, but she'll dig a tunnel anywhere from 12 to 24 inches deep, and at the bottom of that tunnel there are these little chambers or cells. Then she goes to a tree and captures an annual cicada, one of those buzzing insects that we hear from the middle of July till frost. She paralyzes it by stinging it. And that's an interesting distinction. She doesn't kill it. She just paralyzes it. She puts it in that hole in the ground and then lays an egg on the cicada. Her offspring is a larva that will eat the cicada as it grows and develops for the rest of the summer. So a hole in the ground is the typical behavior for this cicada killer wasp. Now, Asian giant hornet builds nests that are not in the ground, and so there's a huge difference there. But the size difference should also give them away. There's lots of pictures online of Asian giant hornet, and you can see the big orange eyes. There's lots of distinguishing characteristics. But when you see this wasp hovering over the ground or going in and out of a hole next to your sidewalk or on your flower bed, it's just our native species, the cicada killer wasp.
And so what should you do if you encounter a cicada killer wasp? What is their behavior generally like towards people and their surrounding areas?
There are two behaviors. The female is working all day long to dig that hole, catch food, provision the nest, provide for her offspring so she can perpetuate the species. So she's focused on that. The second point we need to remember is that only female wasps and bees can sting. So if you were to capture her, if you were to hold her in your hand, you could be stung. But otherwise, she's going to ignore you as you walk by because she's busy doing what she needs to do. The males, on the other hand, having nothing to do but protect their territory, will fly back and forth, up and down your sidewalk, back and forth past your flower bed, and they are protecting their territory where their female, the one they mated, is now building the nest. Male wasps and bees cannot sting you, but they will fly at you. They will dive bomb at you to try to get you away from the female that's doing the work. So two behaviors, working, digging in the ground, buzzing back and forth. Neither one of those is a danger or a threat to us. The interesting thing also is that in spite of the size, the cicada killer wasp sting would not be that potent. So it's not a great threat. Therefore, in your question, what should we do about it? Our suggestion is do nothing. Enjoy the show, tolerate them if you can, but there are treatments available if you really can't withstand the risk of having a hornet burrowing in your yard.
So what are some of the benefits that cicadas may bring to, or cicada killer wasps may bring to our ecosystems, and why should we appreciate their presence?
I don't think we get a lot of direct benefit from cicada killers. We also don't get a lot of benefit from cicadas. So it's a fairly innocuous thing, and I guess a lot of this depends on your worldview, that if you see the interdependent web of life as of which we are all a part, this is just another piece of it that is doing its job, doing its thing, and we can tolerate it, leave it alone. If, on the other hand, you're fearful of being stung, if the letter carrier no longer comes to your house because they are afraid of this wasp, we can treat them and kill them, but there's not a lot of ecological benefit. Certainly there's some aeration and some water penetration into the soil from their tunnels, but this is not one from which we get a lot of benefit, nor do we suffer a lot of harm. Therefore, my suggestion would be to live and let live.
And it also sounds like they probably do not pose a threat to the honeybee.
Right, and that's one of the things that came out about the Asian giant hornet, is that they will attack honeybees and decapitate them. Well, it turns out the bald-faced hornet that we have in Iowa will do that same behavior. We also have robber flies in Iowa that will attack honeybees. Yellow jacket wasps will attack honeybees. So honeybees are fair game for a bunch of predators. It's just this Asian giant hornet is very, very good at killing honeybees. The cicada killer wasp does not. The only thing that fears or needs to fear the cicada killer wasp are the annual cicadas that become food for the offspring down in the ground.
Great. And so also in doing research for the show, I noticed that there is a different type of cicada wasp that I think comes around about every 17 years, right? Is that correct?
The periodical cicada. We have two different kinds of cicadas here in the Iowa and the Midwest. The annual cicada is the one you hear outside from about noon to dusk, from the middle of July until frost. And they make a buzzing sound. It's kind of a zzz, zzz, zzz sound up in the trees. And we get those every year, which is why they're called annual cicadas. Now, the lifespan of an annual cicada is about 3 years. They spent 3 years underground as a nymph and then came out of the ground and hooked to a tree trunk or a post, and they shed their skin. And those empty cicada shells on the tree trunk are probably as familiar to people as the cicada themselves. So those are the annual cicadas. Periodical cicadas are the ones that reappear every 13th or 17th year. And we will have periodical cicadas in eastern Iowa in 2024. We will next have periodical cicadas from Ledges State Park down to the southeast through the Des Moines River Valley in 2031. So it's a long time to wait between emergences of the 13 and 17-year cicadas. But the one we're talking about right now is the annual cicada that shows up in the trees of your backyard every year.
Great. You know, we got a few minutes before the break. Donald, I have an email question here from a listener. He says, what are the insects that build large paper nests that are found in trees?
Those large paper nests that by the time of the fall could be as large as a basketball, sometimes as large as a half bushel basket, that is the bald-faced hornet. Now, that one's misnamed. It's more closely related to yellow jackets, but they build that paper nest out of wood fibers and wasp spit. And it's a black insect with a white face, which is why it's called the bald-faced hornet. And it starts every year from scratch. They build that nest from May until frost, and then they discard it. They go leave it, and they never come back and use the same nest over. So the bald-faced hornet is the one that makes the nest up in the trees. Now, the same kind of nest is made underground by the yellow jacket wasp. So you can see that same kind of nest in two locations, but if it's outside, hanging in a tree or attached
Donald,
to the side of your house.
Donald, we're cutting to a break, but we'll be right back with more Horticulture Day here on Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Matt Alvarez. It's Horticulture Day, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Professor of Entomology, Donald Lewis, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Horticulture Specialist. Donald Lewis, welcome. Donald and Richard, welcome to the program.
Morning.
Glad to be here.
Donald, could we just go back and finish up your thought on the bald-faced hornet right before we went to break?
Sure. Bald-faced hornets build these annual nests. They're the ones that you see up in the trees. They're generally not a threat, but if they were in a high-traffic area, we might control that nest by using a wasp and hornet aerosol spray. The other option is to wait until Thanksgiving when that nest will be empty. You can cut it down, hang it in your living room. They make great conversation pieces.
And I think we just have a little bit of time. Can you tell us a little bit about Japanese beetles?
That's been a hot topic. We've had lots and lots of questions, both to the Hort Line and to the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Japanese beetle feeds on the foliage, flowers, and fruits of about 350 different kinds of plants from about the beginning of July until the second or third week of August. So we are 4 weeks into a 6-week window when they will emerge as adults and be a pest above ground. They will soon be laying their eggs. They'll return underground as larvae, where they will stay until next summer, when we get the next batch of adults. So if you haven't done anything about Japanese beetles by now, it's probably a little too late. Damage is accumulating. They have been feeding on your linden trees, your roses, your grapes since the beginning of July. So they look bad. Just remember that defoliation of deciduous plants is not death. These plants aren't dead. They're just a bit defoliated. They look bad. And it's a hard one to put up with, and it's even harder to control.
Great. And we got a couple email questions to start our second half of the show. So Mike from Waterloo asks, I've recently moved to Waterloo. I planted a garden late, early June, and until the past few days, everything has been growing well. But even with regular watering, my cucumbers have been whittling every day from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. and recovering every evening. We have a lot of rain we had a lot of rain in June, early July, so they never really grew deep roots. Is it just a high temperature or low humidity as a problem that there's nothing to be done, or is there anything that I can do?
Richard, I would do is maybe water thoroughly when they water. Because of that frequent rain earlier on, the plants may have a shallow root system, so they tend to dry out very quickly. So when you do water, water thoroughly. Really soak the ground nice and deep, and that way they'll have a deeper root system and they won't wilt as readily in the future.
Great. And another email question. We removed an overgrown mung bine bush yesterday. My husband keeps referring to it as a tree due to its size. And it was directly next to a 15-year-old tree. The tree is pretty healthy, so I don't want to injure it, but my spouse would like to hire stump removal since the stump is still pretty pronounced. My alternative is to keep the area well mulched and add landscape and perhaps some pots to hide the bump. Though, do you have any thoughts on safely removing that stump?
Well, they don't have to. I mean, it can just rot naturally. Another option would be to maybe very carefully dig a trench just around the trunk and then maybe have someone with a chainsaw very carefully cut off that stump just below the ground and get rid of it.
Great. Let's see. we have a little bit of trouble with the phone lines right now, but we are going to answer another email from Bob. We have a 1/3-acre lot with flowers, beds, and bumblebees all over them, plus bumblers on, what we want to do in the backyard bumblebee court, but struggle how to get accurate estimate of the bumblers as they move from flower to flower and flower bed. 2, is there a good resource that you can recommend bumblebee pictures so I can identify bumblers by species for the count?
Bumblers is an interesting name for bumblebees.
It kind of threw me off.
Bumblebees are very active right now with the high temperatures. Their populations are growing. Bumblebees also have annual colonies. They start from scratch with one female in the springtime, and then they build those colonies through the summer. Identifying bumblebees is not easy on the fly. Some of them we can recognize. We do have a Xerces, that's X-E-R-C-E-S. We have a Xerces Society guide to bumblebees of Iowa. And if they leave a phone number or an email address, we can get that guide to them. It's a website. Actually, if they just contact me I'll give you my email. They can send me an email at insects, I-N-S-E-C-T-S, insects, at iastate.edu. No, there is no easy way to count bumblebees. What we wish we could do is count one, put an X on its back, put it back in the garden, and we say, okay, we've counted you once. We're not going to count you again. But there's no easy way to do that other than just do the best you can. I have the same problem. I'm a surveyor for the Iowa Butterfly Survey Network, and as I do my survey route, sometimes I think, didn't I just see that same monarch? Is she following me? So we just do the best we can with estimates and try to keep moving. I think that's the thing, is that you move through the landscape as you're looking. But, again, Donald, insects at iastate.edu is my email address. If you write to me, I'll send you the link for the Xerces Society Guide to Iowa Butterflies.
We have Tom from Des Moines joining us. Tom, welcome to the program. What would you like to ask?
Hi. I have two questions. The first one is, with the remainder of summer left, what can I reasonably, or even at a slight risk,
I think we, let me go ahead and try and get Tom again. Tom, can you hear us now?
Yes.
Could you go ahead and repeat your question?
Yes. I was wondering, with the remainder of summer left, what I can reasonably plant for food, vegetables. You know, I think I've got maybe, 60 days left or so, or even just sort of pushing the envelope. And the second question was, it has to do with a conversation I had with a plant store owner who said that he plants both vegetable seeds and flowering plants by seed around Halloween. And he feels like it gives them a head start, and he's had pretty good success with getting things to come up as the soil warms. So do the plants start to germinate. I mean, I've only lived here for about 8 years, and so I've never tried to do anything quite like that. I come from a much warmer climate. And I was just wondering if you could comment on those questions.
Well, as far as planting at this point, you could still plant green beans. That needs to be done pronto, as soon as possible. You could also plant beets and carrots. And early September, you could plant leaf lettuce, radishes, spinach. As far as planting seeds this fall, as far as vegetable seeds, that's not going to work. They're not going to germinate next spring. They won't. They'll rot in the ground. You can plant a few flowers like zinnias and marigolds, and they'll actually come up in the spring.
Great. Thanks, Tom, for joining us. Up next is Esther. Esther, what would you like to ask today?
Yes, I think I have a similar question to the last person. I live in far northwest Iowa, and I want to plant spinach, lettuce, radishes, et cetera, and wondering when the optimum time to do that is.
Since you're in the northern part of the state, probably the last week or so in August.
Great. Esther, hope that answered your question. Joan from Hawkeye is next. Joan, what would you like to ask our horticulturist?
I have a question about autumn blaze maple trees. My neighbor has an autumn blaze, and it's already turned. It's only July. And she has a friend that had one of these trees, and it turned in August and died the next year. Now, I have two autumn blaze maple trees, and I'm just wondering, is there a problem with these trees?
Well, that one tree, there is a problem. Trees, when they're under stress, they typically send out warning signs. And a very clear warning sign is when the leaves color early. So that one tree is under stress from some type of thing, and now it's turning early. A lot of things affect the health of trees: insects, disease, weather, cultural practices, girdling roots. So a lot of things affect the health of the tree. But that one tree obviously is under stress. If your trees are not doing that, they're perfectly fine.
Thanks for calling in, Joan. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us an email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Again, if you're just tuning in, Iowa State University Professor of Entomology Donald Lewis is joining us today for Hort Day, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Horticulture Specialist. We have an email from Caroline from Cedar Falls. Caroline asks, I have a peppermint and sage in pots on my deck. I've been watering daily most days. Some leaves are turning yellow. Is overwatering the cause? If not, what could it be? Help.
Well, hopefully there are drainage holes in the bottom of the pot. And what I would do is, when you water, continue to add water until water begins to flow out the bottom. That way you have some idea that, yes, that entire soil ball has been moistened. Then I would come back the next day and, with my eyes and my finger, check the soil. And if the surface is still moist, that plant doesn't need to be watered. If the surface is getting dry, then go ahead and water. Now, obviously, in the middle of summer, those plants tend to dry out very quickly, and so you should check every day. Later on, as we get into late summer, early fall, and the weather moderates, watering isn't as important, but right now they should check every day.
RJ from Forest City is on the line now. RJ, thanks for joining us. And we lost RJ. Okay. we have another email. Dennis, I believe this one's for you. What are the pros and cons of putting out a beetle collection bag?
Well, the pro of using a Japanese beetle trap is that you get the emotional satisfaction of seeing hundreds or thousands of dead, slimy, decaying beetles. That comes with the aroma of dead beetles, of course. So the advantage is you get to feel like you did something. The disadvantage is Japanese beetle traps attract more than they catch. So if you put this trap near what you're trying to protect, you're actually luring the beetles from all of your neighbors to your garden. So you have to put this trap far away if you are going to go that route. The final analysis is we can't tell that it makes any difference. You can kill tens of thousands of beetles in your trap out of the tens of millions that are in your county, and it really isn't reflected in less damage to the plants. Now, if you were brand new to Japanese beetle, if you've never had them before, the trap might make a difference for the first couple of years, but if you're in the exponential growth phase of the invasion cycle, you won't see any benefit to the plants from the Japanese beetle trap other than you feel good having killed a lot of them.
And that email was from Becky. Becky, I hope that answers your question. We got RJ back on the line. RJ.
Hi.
Hey.
Sorry. My question was, I got stung on the top of the hand about 3 years ago by something, and that was the most painful and scary experience, as it sent pain and numbness right up through my arm all the way up to my shoulder, and I thought it was headed toward my heart, but it didn't. What kind of wasp or bee would have that, could pack that kind of punch?
Dennis, would you like to take this?
Well, we should ask where you were. If you were in the tropics, we could name things like bullet ants and a few others that are known for their painful sting. Here in Iowa, the yellow jacket wasps and the paper wasps are about the most painful stinger that we have. Honeybees are actually kind of a moderate sting for a pain level for most people, but it really varies on where the stinger lands in your skin, your own sensitivity, and so forth. So there was an interesting research many years ago where I believe he was a graduate student at the time, as in who else would do this. He actually tested the stings of all the different kinds of insects on all the different parts of his body and rated the pain. So we know it's variable from place to place on your body. We know it's variable from species to species, but that still doesn't answer the mystery of what was this particular stinger. I guess I'll have to finish by saying, there was no lasting effect, was there?
It was an email, but RJ actually disconnected. Yeah.
Well, we just hope that the pain didn't last for long. When we're talking about stinging insects, it's important to remember that if there is any reaction away from the sting site, as in you have difficult breathing, you feel tightness of the chest, you feel a tingling in your lips or on your tongue, you need medical attention because you're in experiencing an anaphylactic shock. If it swells up at the site and doesn't go any further, it'll probably resolve in a matter of time, but stinging has the potential to have severe consequences. So when you're in doubt, seek medical help from a stinging insect.
We have just a little less than a minute before our next break. I have one. I have time for a quick email question. I have been trying for years to establish a stand of hollyhocks, but I haven't had much luck until this summer. Now I have several good-looking plants randomly scattered around my lot. Is it possible to transplant some of them, and when? That's from Delbert.
It's a possibility. They could try it maybe late this summer, maybe like in early to mid-September, and dig it up and try to keep that root system intact and put it right back in the ground, water well, or possibly very early next spring too.
And we are coming up on our next break where Iowa State University Professor of Entomology Donald Lewis is here and Richard Duran is also here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Matt Alvarez. It's Hort Day, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Professor of Entomology, Donald Lewis, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Horticulturist Specialist. We're going to go right back to the phone lines. We have Jerry in Cedar Rapids. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Hello, good morning.
What would you like to ask, Jerry?
I have a 35-year-old dwarf cherry tree that is possibly past its prime. It does produce cherries, but 2 weeks before the cherries are ready, it gets a brown, gritty substance on many of the cherries, which makes them unusable. And I have tried fungus control on it, but I'm not sure what it is, if there is anything that can be done, or if it indicates the tree is ready to come down.
Well, I will say a 35-year-old cherry tree is quite remarkable. They tend to be short-lived. 20, 25 years is more common. But as far as the fruit, that's a different issue. That may be some type like a brown rot. And as far as controlling that, you have to start early with your fungicide, beginning basically right before even flowering. So you may want to go to your computer and look under brown rot, because that may be what you're seeing on the cherries.
Great, Jerry. I hope that answers your question. We have Dan in Des Moines. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Hey, guys. We have mature lilac, peony, and a big butterfly bush in the front around the house. They're all, you know, 5-6 feet by, you know, 5 or 6 feet. Is a good time right now to trim them back?
Well,
you know, they've already flourished. They've already done their thing.
So you have a butterfly bush, a lilac, and what else?
A big peony.
Okay. As far as the peony, that is a herbaceous perennial, and I would cut that back basically to the ground in late October, early November. That's fine. As far as the lilac, if you need to prune that, there are basically two options. One is to prune it in late March, early April, before it begins to leaf out, but that will reduce the number of flowers in the spring. But if you need to do some heavy pruning, I would do it then. If you want to do some light pruning, then I would prune it right after blooming, within a week or two of blooming. As far as the butterfly bush, that is a woody plant, but in Iowa, it typically dies back to near ground level every winter. And what I would do is simply wait until it begins to grow, look for signs of growth, and then basically cut off everything that's dead. And typically, you may see some growth in the bottom, let's say, 3-4 inches of the plant.
Okay. Okay, as far as the butterfly branch, you're saying cut off the woody, like, down to the ground, or?
Well, right. The butterfly bush is a woody plant, but usually in Iowa, much of it dies back. And so I would want to wait until it begins to grow, to produce some new growth, look for that new growth, and then prune out everything above that point that basically is dead, that's not leafing out. And usually in Iowa, you might see some growth on the bottom 3 to 4 inches of the plant.
Excellent. Okay. Great. Thank you, guys.
Thanks. We have Kylie in Des Moines also. Kylie, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much. I had a question about wildflowers. So I just moved into my first home and would like to plant a lot of the wildflower seeds I have, and was wondering if I can still do that now or if I should wait until next spring.
Well, it depends upon what you're trying to do. Now, some wildflowers you can buy as potted plants. For example, purple coneflower, butterfly weed. So there are a number of plants that you can actually buy that are plants, and they're much, much easier to establish. As far as seed, that's a possibility too, but it's more difficult because you tend to end up with a lot of weeds coming up also. So if it's a small area, I would typically recommend buying plants.
Great. Thanks, Kylie. And our next caller on the line is Dale. Dale, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I have a pear tree that the leaves are rubbery but black. It came with a house, and it's extremely tall, and it is producing, the first year was 5 years ago, it's producing really good, but the fruit was woody, and now they're very small, and they're dropping way too early and unedible.
Well, fire blight is something fairly common on pears, but that typically is limited in that this is usually at the tips of the branches where maybe the upper 6-12 inches of that shoot, all the leaves turn a dark brown or black. They shrivel up, but they don't fall off. And everything below that is perfectly healthy, perfectly green. So fire blight is fairly common. That is a bacterial disease, and there's no fungicide that's going to control it. Typically, what you do on that is you go out with a pruning shears and you prune out the affected areas. And in doing so, you actually make the pruning cut around 6 to 8 inches below the brown areas to make sure you get it all. And after each pruning cut, you take your pruning shears and you dip the pruning shears in some type of disinfectant, like a bleach solution or something of that order, to make sure you're not spreading it. Now, if that's not what you're seeing, if you're seeing black over much of the tree, that typically would not be fire blight. You can take some photos of the tree itself and maybe some close-up photos of the actual foliage and send those to our plant disease clinic here at Iowa State. Their email address is pidc@iastate.edu, and simply attach the photos to the email.
I will do that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dale. We have an email from Tom and Granger. And Donald, I believe this one would be for you. We have an invasion of the fig eater beetle in the first and second week of July. This is the first time that we've seen this beetle. It's a loud, clumsy flyer, beautiful green, and they seem to enjoy the garden compost. Is there any worries about this new character visiting our garden?
Tell me again, what was the location?
And Granger.
Granger, okay. The green June beetle is a huge member of that family. It's about an inch long. It has kind of a velvety green color and little gold stripes kind of at the edges of the wings. And it gets this name fig eater because it eats lots of fruits as they're ripening. So it could be moderately damaging, but we have so few of those in Iowa, the Granger may actually be the farthest north that I've heard of. So I'll have to look at my map to make sure. So it's not a common insect through Iowa. It's only been found in the southern half. You know, not a lot of them. You can probably battle the ones you see without having to resort to the heavy artillery. But it's an interesting insect. It's kind of fun to watch. It's a member of the June bug family. It just happens to be a big green member, so we call it the green June bug.
Great. And we're heading right back to the phone lines. Liz. Liz is next on our program. Liz, welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. I am in Northwest Iowa, and I am preparing to plant my second crop of shelling peas.
I've prepared my site around my trellis, and I'm just wondering, should I start planting them now, or should I wait until later August?
I think I'd probably wait another couple of weeks and do it promptly at that time, so maybe around the 10th, 14th of August.
Okay. All right, sounds good. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Liz. Martha in Washington County is next. Martha, welcome to the show.
Hi. I have this insect that I've had for a while, for like about a week, and I found it on when I was weeding in my tomatoes, and it was a caterpillar about, oh, maybe even 3 inches long, really neat looking, bright green with diagonal white stripes. Mm-hmm. So anyways, my husband said it's a bad guy because it's eating tomatoes, and I said, I want to show it to my grandchild. So I put it in this big plastic jar on the front porch in the shade, and I've been feeding it tomato, the foliage and stuff, leaves and stuff. And anyway, I don't know what I'm doing, and I don't want to hurt it, but now it's a little way shorter, and it's dark brown, and it's still alive because I just checked on it.
Yeah. We have two species that are collectively called the tomato hornworm. Yours should have either a green or a red horn on the last segment of the body. Those diagonal lines are very distinctive, and it's common on tomato plants. They can feed on a few other things like tobacco, but we see them on tomatoes. It's fun to raise. I appreciate that you're showing it to your grandchild. This is part of learning about nature, that there are things that will hurt our crops, but you're likely to have more tomatoes than you and the neighbors will be able to eat anyway, so one of them is not a huge problem. Sometimes we get so many of them that the tomatoes are completely defoliated and we take control actions like picking them off. The difficulty raising this particular insect is when it is done eating at about 3 inches in length, they will burrow into the ground to make the transformation into the pupal stage. They make their pupa underground, and then the moth, that is the end of this life cycle, will emerge the following spring. So this one may be at that point in its development where it doesn't want to eat anymore. It's ready to burrow into the ground and make a pupa, and there's no easy way to do that. I think I would put it back in the garden and say, we enjoyed watching you for a while. We enjoyed the watching you eat the tomatoes and turn that into fecal pellets, and we had to shovel out the cage as if it was a livestock. But it might be time for that one to go back to the garden so it can finish its development underground.
Oh, okay. And if I keep track of where I put it, I might be able to see it again, right?
Yeah, you might.
Maybe.
But they tend to wander when they get to the ground.
Oh.
When they drop off the plant after eating all they can eat, they drop off the plant. They tend to wander for a while. And, of course, they have no digging equipment, so they have to find a crack in the soil where they can go underground to make this next stage, this pupal stage. So, sure, keep track of where you put it, and hopefully you'll see the moth next spring on a nighttime visit to the garden.
Okay, but it's normal that it's gotten smaller and brown, and it was really pooping a whole bunch at first.
Yes, I think this is an indication that it's ready to quit being an eating machine and transform to the adult moth.
All right, thanks, Martha. We have just a few minutes left on this Horte edition of Talk of Iowa. Sasha in Columbus Junction, you're next.
Hi. So we have a pretty large farm, hobby farm in southeastern Iowa. All of our land, about 200 acres, is in CRP. Our front yard, where we currently mow, like most folks, next year we're going to be doing some dirt work to flatten it out. We want to let it go back to kind of prairie or indigenous Iowa grasses and plants. What's a suggestion you have on maybe somewhere I could get more information on what would naturally come there? And then how do I go about getting that in place and getting our yard looking the way it used to?
You're going to have to buy a seed mix that if you don't do that, you're going to end up with mostly weeds. So you need to buy a seed mix. There are a number of companies that sell seed mixes. There are some regional companies, some fairly big companies. For example, there's Ion Exchange in Harpers Ferry, Iowa. Ion Exchange. There's the Prairie Moon Nursery in Minnesota, and the Prairie Nursery in Wisconsin. But there are other companies too. Now, if you type in those names on a search engine, Prairie Moon Nursery, Prairie Nursery, Ion Exchange, they have very good websites where they have various mixes, and they even have planning information as far as how to do it.
Okay. And then we have, within our pasture now, I mean, as you would expect, there's some thistle here and there. And that's always been a problem, like when we till the garden, we kind of battle it constantly. And we don't use any kind of pesticides or herbicides on our farm at all. So outside of just pulling those while we're growing the prairie grass, is there anything I can do to deter those?
Boy, they're hard to control because, for example, if it's a Canada thistle, they have a deep root system. And pulling them is simply not practical. It's not going to work. You could try repeatedly digging them up. Usually herbicides are the most effective.
Okay. Thank you so much.
We have just about a minute left. I want to see if we can get this one email question answered. I know it's from Bill in Des Moines. He says, what can he cut his tall tiger lilies low to the ground now that they are done blooming?
I would not, because that foliage, if it's green, that foliage is manufacturing food. And then storing that food, some of that food back in the bulb. And this is true for most perennials like peonies and everything else. The more food they can store in their bulb or in their roots, the better the flower production next spring or summer. So typically, if the foliage is nice and green, leave it. Do not cut it back. You could cut it back in mid to late October. That's fine.
Great. Well, Iowa State University professor entomology, Donald Lewis, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Matt. You did a great job.
Appreciate it. And Iowa State University professor, Iowa State University horticulture specialist, Richard Duran, thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. It's a also produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and myself, Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We'll be back next Friday with Horticulture Day and Charity Nebbe on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Matt Alvarez. Thanks for listening.